Welcome to 2-Bit Writers with Joseph Chinnock. 2-Bit Writers is a show where writers talk about writing. The good, the bad, the ugly, the outlaw and beaten down, the overrated and the unsung, the madness, sorrow, and melancholy and heartbreak of poetry and prose. Imagine you're sitting in a saloon listening to Frank and Jesse James talk about robbing a bank. Pull up a chair and pour yourself a glass of whiskey, and let's get to it. Today's show is about identity and how that identity shapes a writer in their writing. We have clips of Annis Nin reading from The Glass Bell, Santa Fe poet laureate John Davis reading his poem, The New Americans, and the opening page of Atticus Lish's brilliant debut novel, Preparation for the Next Life. Also, a variety of aging hipster music from The Violent Femmes, The Dead Kennedys, and The Pixies. I will also interview scary smart writer, musician, and children's show creator, Tammy Stoner from Portland, Oregon. Okay, cue aging hipster music. Let's start with the highest form of writing, poetry. This is Annis Nin reading from her classic, Under a Glass Bell.
I'm going to read the story, Under a Glass Bell, from the collection by that title. It was a stately house where many lives had accumulated and left their essences. It had the perfume of rich lives, of heavily impregnated furniture, and the very folds of the curtains contained secrets and sighs. It was also a house that seemed about to vanish. The tip of the labyrinthian stairway leading to the gate lost itself among the potted plants, the turret dissolved into the overhanging branches of old trees. The glass doors and windows opened without sound. The floors were so highly polished, they looked transparent.
So I'd like to welcome Tammy Stoner to 2-Bit Writers. Tammy's been published in Folio, Unshod Quills, The Portland Review, 10,000 Tons of Black Ink, Piff Magazine, Microfiction Monday Magazine, Literary Orphans, Urban Syntax, Draft, Society, The Pale House Collective, and more anthologies than I can count. Tammy has also been a gas station attendant, a warehouse pallet lift operator, a roadie for Willie Nelson, a medical guinea pig, a waitress at a Greek diner, a house cleaner, bookstore manager, and the fiction editor of Gertrude Press. On the side, Tammy teaches college, paints, makes music, and constantly eats out in Portland with her wife and three wonderful children. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. So I wanted to start about talking about identity or identities in writing. And it seems like most writers have a checkered past, but you have a multi-checkered past. You're
Uh-oh.
I mean, that's a compliment, of course. Yeah. In the sense that your mother, your wife, lesbian, you've been an editor, gas station attendant, short story writer, and novelist. And I guess I'm intrigued in which of those identities, or do any of those identities impact you most as a writer?
As a writer, well, You know, it's really interesting because I don't write memoir at all. Well, I once or twice I kind of snuck it in there because it was assigned to me or sort of like a dare. But in general, I don't. So for me, the fiction that I write is a, you know, it's an accumulation of everything. You know, so with Spots in Sugarland, you know, a lot of it has to do with Texas, which is where I was born and where I spent, that's actually where I was a gas station attendant too, where I spent a couple of years when I was older. And, you know, it's my heart's always been in the South because I think sometimes where you're born, you just sort of get your compass set there or something. So there's that part of it. And, you know, the whole coming out process is essentially, you know, a huge part of the novel too. So I can't really say what affects me more. I think being a mother affects me as a reader. I'm way more sensitive to material now than I ever was when I was younger. You know, I can't read anything about child abuse, you know, all these kinds of things that I used to be able to read through. Never really liked it, but if I came across it, it wasn't sort of triggery. But now that kind of stuff affects me a lot more. But yeah, I think my reading has probably been more affected by motherhood, and the rest of it, I think, affects my writing.
So, you know, I didn't know you're from Texas. What part of Texas are you from?
I was born down in Midland, Texas, and then my brother was born in El Paso, so that whole Odessa, you know, that whole area down there. And then I went back a while later and lived in Austin for a couple of years there, back in the 90s.
How long were you in Texas? I mean, were you born and raised there into your teens, or did you leave
No, we moved around quite a bit when I was younger. So I was born in Midland, and then we moved to El Paso, where my brother was born, so that would be a couple of years. And then we moved to Gulfport, Mississippi, I think, when I was 5. And then we sort of made our way up to Pennsylvania, where I stayed through college, through my undergraduate program.
I was listening to Karen Russell speak in Santa Fe last night, and she was talking about growing up in Florida and how that's influenced her work so much, even though she ended up going to school in New York and now she lives in Portland. But, you know, the author of Swamplandia, that whole kind of gothic, almost, I don't know if you call it self-mythologizing, but mythic sense of place and culture. Maybe we exaggerate a little bit in our writing. That sounds like something that's been important to you, and now you're going back to it with your most recent novel. Why don't you do the intro to your novel? I've got it here, but I think it'd sound better coming from you.
Oh, God. The intro to my novel, you mean just tell you what it's about, basically?
Yeah, Spots in Sugarland.
Yeah, you know, I struggle with this a lot because the novel's pretty large, so it covers, you know, about 65 years. But it starts back in the 1920s in Texas with a female prison cook, and the novel follows her life as she develops into becoming this matriarch for this family of trailer park Texas misfits that come together after she sort of accepts who she is, which, of course, has a lot to do with her ultimately coming out from moving from a non-practicing lesbian to a practicing one in her 60s. And then that would be... oh, probably about the 1970s or so.
Who does she, I'm going to prompt you a little bit, but who does she meet that helps her kind of come out and kind of to herself into to the culture as well?
Well, this is actually the starting point for the entire novel was, I think, if you're talking about Lead Belly, the portion of prison, yeah. So back in the early portion of the book, she ends up getting a job at Sugarland Penitentiary, which is in Sugarland, Texas, home to the Imperial Sugar People. And when she's there, she meets Lead Belly, and he, the infamous blues singer, he actually was there during that time. And so there's a big part of it that's historical fiction centered around him. And he had this amazing story that I read before I started writing the novel that he was in prison, and they gave him a guitar, and he started playing on Sundays for the guards and for folks that would come by. And one of the people that came by was the governor, and his wife, and Pat Neff was his name, and Leadbelly sung a song to the governor begging for clemency, and the governor actually pardoned him and released him from jail based on this song. So when I heard this story, I thought, you know, it's amazing. And so the novel sort of grew oddly from the nucleus that is deeper into the book, you know, like page 50 is when this sort of happens. So the novel kind of grew out like a weed from that point. But yeah, so her meeting with him really saw parallels in their lives. And he really helped her to leave prison because he said, you know, if I leave, if I get my clemency, if I'm going to be brave enough to go out there, then you know, need to basically quit your job and stop imprisoning yourself and go out and try to live a life too.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the sort of, you know, impetus for her leaving the prison and getting started on life.
He sang for his freedom twice, didn't he?
He sang again. So he was granted clemency, I think it was back in 1924, officially from the governor, who had seen him play in 1923. And it was one of his last acts because he had said part of his campaign was that he wasn't going to release any violent people, presumably, of course, violent black people back in the day. So he then went out, Leadbelly did, got himself wrapped up in some trouble again. And I think it was in 1930 that he sang again, and I believe he also wrote a letter. And he got out again and then went to New York and started recording. And I think he got 8 more months because he tried to stab somebody again in New York.
Jeez.
So clearly not the best with anger management, but a beautiful, beautiful blues singer.
It's a beautiful story. And, you know, my understanding of Southern prisons is that at that time you could get worked to death in prison, especially if you're on a chain gang.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the Sugar Land prison was actually situated on an old plantation, and they did have a good portion of the prison would work the fields, you know, and they used straps, and it was essentially slavery again in the prisons. Yeah.
All right. So let me back up to the previous question then. So I guess about 10 years ago, a lot of kind of queer writing came out. Do you consider yourself a queer writer? I mean, do you ever think of yourself that way, or is it just kind of informed by life experience, really?
Yeah, I never think about it in that way at all. You know, I have a collection of short stories that I just finished, and there's really only two in the story that are queer, and the rest either the issue doesn't come up, or, you know, it involves more traditional partnerships with people. You know, it just seems to be whatever the story needs at the time. You know, the new novel that I'm starting now has, you know, three main characters, and one is gay and two are not. So I think it's important, but I don't sit down with the purpose of writing from a queer perspective. I think that's just comes naturally.
Karen Russell last night was talking about being a novelist is kind of like being in a long, comforting, if sometimes frustrating, monogamous relationship with a project. And then being a short story writer is kind of like jumping from bed to bed and having all these kind of, you know, different experiences with different projects that you can wrap up fairly quickly or very quickly if you feel like it. Do you come to these different genres, just like what's moving you at the moment? What's your process for getting into a creative project?
For writing, it used to be very much just spray bullets at the wall kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I would literally spend a decade writing a novel, and it would get so strangulated in you know, manic direction, directionlessness, that I started not outlining, but forcing myself to a conclusion. So I'll know where it's going to end, and I have to get there, you know. And if I start traveling too far off the path, then I have to cut and come back again. I don't sit down, though, and say, well, this is going to be a short story or this is going to be a novel. I mean, Spots in Sugarland actually started as three different short stories written about this family, much, I think, you're talking about Karen Russell, much the same, I think, that she developed Swamplandia based on some short stories that were centered around this family that just sort of insisted on getting more air in a way. So I was actually at Tin House, and I was talking with Steve Allman, and he's the one that said, you know, look, you should put these short stories together, and you should, you know, build a world around the structure. So so that's what I did. But I hadn't set out to initially write a book, especially one this long.
Yeah, Karen said when she started St. Rita's School for Girls, it started out as kind of a joke of a rhyming poem.
Yeah,
about these werewolf girls who are rehabilitated by nuns. And it just kind of took on a life of its own. The legendary Steve Allman, author of Candy Freak, come on. He's been a big influence on both of us. He's a fantastic writer and a fantastic writing teacher, too. I'm going to kind of take a little bit of a tangent question about writing, kind of the craft of writing. And I think Steve has talked about this too, that we live in a very visual culture. If you look at the top three grossing mediums, the first one's actually pornography. Second one's video games, and third is movies. So, you know, when you're writing anything, I think of it like, you know, these video game makers have 100 brilliant people describing water. Like, you know, how does water look at night? And how does water look in Japan? How does water look in space? And so sometimes I freeze up. I think like, well, I'm describing this water and it's blue. Like, so, I mean, do you think about that in terms of how visual the culture is? And you know, at any moment someone can go online and look at anything under the sun. Or do you, are you kind of like old school, just like, I'm going to write my prose and if they love it, they'll come?
Probably a little combination. I lived in Los Angeles for a while, and I wrote a bunch of screenplays. So that helped me tremendously in understanding a scene, you know, and keeping it brief and keeping it in tune. I mean, obviously with this novel, it's a Southern voice. So that gave me a little bit more leeway to not ramble, but to make my point at the end of a line. So, but I still try to keep things pretty cinematic and pretty tight, just in general. And I will use sort of screenplay analysis when I go through an editing process and say, you know, really basic 101 kind of crap, but like, you know, what, where am I at by the quote unquote page 10, or, you know, where's my, you know, where are my scenes coming together? And I use Scrivener now, which is amazing. And so I can see, I can break it out by chapter, and I can literally see the pacing and what's too long and what's the angle on each chapter. And does a scene start one way and end the opposite? Or, you know, I kind of apply those methods to the editing of fiction.
Can you describe Scrivener for the listeners, what it is?
Yeah, it's just a writing program. I think it's pretty cheap, too. So if you're on the fence about it, I mean, just, you know, it's like the cost of three Manhattans. So the Manhattan rule. And it allows you to break each chapter down and color code everything from point of view. It gives you automatic word counts. It has little note cards that you can attach that are automatically attached to each chapter. So if I wanted to change the movement in it, rather than cutting and pasting and having to find my way around this massive thing, I just move the file of the chapter around. And so especially with something, again, that was this long, when I did the timeline, I put the date as the first, you know, 1922/chapter 1. So I'd have the year. And when I did that in Scrivener and I lined it all up, I saw that I was really heavy, like in 1955, and really heavy in 1923. And so I wanted to make sure to balance it out a little bit more. So that program, if you are visual, and I'm very, very visual, that program is a tremendous help for the editing process.
That's something screenwriters and writers used to do with index cards, right? Put it up on
that's
the
wall.
That's
what I always did with index cards, and put it up and moved it around. But then you have to do it in the book, which, you know, when you move one chapter, it changes all your page numbers. You know, you're searching for everything by words. It's just a pain in the ass. So for visual people, Scrivener is an amazing program.
Let me take that one step further. I saw J.K. Rowling, a schematic she had, and I've seen this with Stephen King, too, where they map out where every character is at even when they're not on the page.
Yeah.
Like, incredibly specifically, not just like, yeah, they're in L.A. or New York. Like, what are they actually doing? Who are they talking to? And all those kinds of things. Do you go that far?
No. I mean, the blocking of that level of, you know, thrilling slash horror slash, you know, whatever, I think that demands that you have a lot more tension and you have a lot more control, maybe. But I'm pretty rigorous. As a matter of fact, for the new book I'm writing, I just taped a bunch of poster board together. It's the exact size of my closet door. And I have the world built out on that, so I can see the map of this world and where everybody is on it. So I don't get as detailed as they do, but I'm pretty attentive about it.
What's the name of that book?
Scrape and Burn.
Oh, I like it. Scrape and Burn. And that's short stories?
No, that's going to be a metaphysical, which I guess is the new hip word for dystopian. It's not really dystopian, but it is a little set in 2073.
Wow. So, yeah. Karen Russell was talking about that last night. She's like, how do you write a dystopian novel in a dystopian society? She's like,
yeah, you can't.
You almost have to write a utopian novel.
Metaphysical.
I like metaphysical or magical. She was saying she got labeled as magical realist, and as a female writer, it was almost like a quaint thing. Like, oh, that's so quaint that you write about, you know, werewolves and nuns. But I like metaphysical. Well, thanks so much for your time. Good talking to you, as always. And any last thoughts you want to say to the listeners on writing or reading or being a mother or musician?
No, I mean, I guess if anybody out there is a writer or practicing to be a writer, I mean, I think honestly the best thing you can do is not to listen to other people, and you know,
especially your family.
Don't read the books. Don't learn your own craft. Create your own craft, and you'll develop a confidence in your voice that it doesn't depend on what other people say you should be doing. So just keep writing and plug your ears as much as possible.
Hey! Been trying to meet you.
This is Santa Fe Poet Laureate John Davis reading his poem, The New Americans.
They are rising from duckweed shoals on slippery haunches, front feet changed into grasping hands, thumbs and forearms thickened for commerce, mouths too bony for kissing. They will breathe through their skins. Their eyes will be keened for motion. They will be maculate. Stricken with appetite. They will lunge with purpose, long tongues speaking the language of capture, shouting the single verb of longing in the dialect of hunger. They will grunt and snore nightly in the tall grass, while gods made in their image bellow beside the river of heaven. They will jockey in the weed banks. They will turn, nothing human in their eyes. Just the hard measure, the precision, the unswerving focus. They will be mystics wired to the gods' wishes. They will leap before they know they are leaping.
Join us next time on 2-Bit Writers when we interview MacArthur Genius Grant winner and best-selling author Karen Russell. And we also consider the question of what is truly real versus what's fantasy and where the intersection is between the two. Instead of aging hipster music, we'll have a rockabilly soundtrack. See you then.